When it comes to maximizing time in the uplands, without fail, Onyx Hunt is my most valuable tool. From planning my next hunt through a new bird cover to navigating in the field, Onyx Hunt is truly with me wherever I go. With detailed mapping and satellite imagery, along with a multitude of map layers from land access to forestry and habitat information, and easy-to-use tools to mark, measure, and catalog important information, Onyx Hunt seamlessly integrates digital scouting with boots-on-the-ground time in the field. With offline mapping and Apple CarPlay integration, you are free to explore the wild landscapes our beloved upland birds inhabit. Planning your next move in the uplands begins with knowing where you stand, and for me, that starts and stops with Onyx Hunt. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com. This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit, handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey everybody, welcome to episode number 266 of the Birdshot Podcast. Our guest today is Craig Koshick. We'll be talking about pointing dogs today and the two amazing books that Craig has written on the topic. And there might be a third on the horizon of a slightly different variety. So stay tuned for that. First, I've got our latest Patreon giveaway winner, Joe from Idaho, a paying patron member and winner of a one-year subscription to Onyx Elite. If you want to be eligible for the next Patreon giveaway, get signed up and get access to some bonus content and the Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers. You can learn more and sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. All right, everybody, it's April, springtime, wherever you are, maybe. We still have a good bit of snow on the ground here from our late March blizzard, but it is melting quite quickly and probably won't be around a whole lot longer. Spring break time, turkey hunting, fishing, it's all in play or about to be real soon. I'll be headed down to Destin, Florida this month, actually. Never been there before. Thought I would mention it here on the podcast, selfishly, just in case any listeners out there have any recommendations for outdoor activities, fun things to do. Could be anything, really, while we're down there. Could be family-friendly, perhaps. Haven't looked into any fishing charters or anything like that, but if you've spent any time in that area and have a recommendation, feel free to email that to me, nick@birdshotpodcast.com. Looking forward to spending some time back down in the South. All right, on with the show. We are talking to Craig Koshick today. You may know him from some of his writing, often featured in Hunting Dog Confidential. There's a Hunting Dog Confidential podcast that he and Jennifer Wapinski have done. And he's also the author of Pointing Dogs, Volume 1 and 2, these being incredible compilations of writing, photography, history, breed profiles of pointing dogs. Most recently released being Volume 2, featuring pointing dogs of the British and Irish breeds. For all you Setter fans out there, Irish, Gordon, Red, English Pointers, Pointers, whatever you call them. This is the book to have, but they are both worth owning if you are a bird dog, pointing dog fan, and as Craig will tease later in the show, he is working on something for the retriever folks out there as well. If you don't know much about Craig, He may as well be a historian. He is full of interesting anecdotes and factoids. I could have talked to him all day and hope to again someday soon. You can get a copy of Pointy Dogs Volume 2 via the ProjectUpland.com website. As Craig will point out in the episode today, very limited supply on Volume 1, but Volume 2 is available. It's ProjectUpland.com. Get yourself a copy. There is plenty to read about and plenty to look at in these big coffee table style books that are just beautiful. So with that said, let's welcome into the conversation and onto the Birdshot Podcast, Craig Koshick.
You know what? The number one question, hey, when are you going to be on a podcast, or when are you going to do another Hunting Dog Confidential podcast? That's the number one question.
Yeah.
Especially the one that Jennifer and I did, Hunting Dog Confidential. People want to hear that more. Yeah. And so actually moving forward in the new year, I just bought a new house. We're actually moving just slightly out of Winnipeg. We're moving to a smaller town. And I'm going to set up a video, a YouTube sort of a place, like a video recording studio.
Okay.
And I'm going to do my own sort of video podcast as well. So I'll invite you on.
I would love to compare
the differences between. We'll compare the differences between Manitoba and grouse hunting up here and grouse hunting where you're at.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. So I did want to ask you that. I knew you were north of the border. You're in more or less Winnipeg.
I live at the moment. Okay. Yeah, I live in Winnipeg. I was born and raised here, but my wife is from Quebec, so I've lived in a number of places, but we eventually moved back to Manitoba to live in Winnipeg, and we've been here now 25 years or more, 28 years, something like that. So
okay. So dumb question. Is that Eastern Canada?
Yeah, so Quebec is the French-speaking part of Canada.
Yeah.
So my wife and I, we speak French at home. We have for the last, like, that's where we met. I went to college out there. I went to university in Quebec. And that's where we met. And so, but in Manitoba is also, there are some French-speaking people here. There's a native population of French speakers as well. It's a small minority, but it's not unusual to hear French here as well. But yeah, she's from Quebec, which is the place where, outside of Montreal, nobody speaks English there, really.
Right.
It's very, very French place. It's a beautiful place with some of the best upland hunting in the world. The woodcock and grouse hunting there can be outstanding.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, so my geography is not the best, but I feel like I have a general idea. But honestly, when I think Canada, my mom tells me I am a quarter French Canadian, Craig. So maybe we'll get into that. But her maiden name is Morisot. So,
when we go to northern Minnesota, Wisconsin, actually all throughout the Midwest and the States, we see nothing but French names for cities and towns. And for us, a great lot of fun is actually trying to figure out how the Americans pronounce that word, because we know how we pronounce it, but then it's like, okay, well, how do they do it?
Yeah, how did you say it?
What, your last name?
Morisot.
Yeah, Morisot.
Morisot. Morisot, okay.
Morisot.
Yeah,
yeah. That and so French. Morisot, and the funniest one is in South Dakota, the capital of South Dakota, which I call Pierre, because it's a name, Pierre, the name of a man. And, but when you go there, they call it Pierre.
Yeah.
And then when I ask the people who live in Pierre, I go, do you know where the name comes from? They go, yeah, it's named after a guy named Pierre, but they call it Pierre. I could never figure that out, but you're near Mille Lacs. You have, Mille Lacs, you say.
Yeah.
There's all kinds, in Minnesota. As we drive through Minnesota and Wisconsin, we've done that several times. We come across all kinds of French names. And so there were lots and lots of French Canadians there. And in fact, one of the local heroes in Manitoba, so one of the founders, the grandfather or the father of the founder of Manitoba, is a guy named Lajmodière. He was a buffalo hunter, and he lived near where Winnipeg is now. And in the mid-1800s, the settlers that were coming from Scotland got into trouble here. They were starving. They needed support. And their patron from Scotland was actually in Montreal at that time. And Lajmodière, who was a buffalo hunter, Métis, French Indian guy, he decided that he needed to go to Montreal to tell their sponsor or their patron that they needed help. So he walked. He left in October and walked from Winnipeg to Duluth down the Pembina Trail. And then he walked all the way to Montreal. Okay, so around the Great Lakes, we're talking, you know, past Toronto and then up to Montreal. He got there just like in January or February. Imagine walking that distance in winter, right? And he got there, he found Lord Selkirk, their sponsor, their patron, and said to him, look, your people are starving back home. You need to send them provisions. You need to send support. He said, okay, I will. He got on it. Then Lajimodière turned around and walked back. Yeah. So he left in October and he got back in like March or April.
Wow.
But it is called the Pembina Trail.
Where'd you read about that?
In history books. Yeah. We didn't learn a lot about it in school. I had to learn about it afterwards because our school was very English dominated and the French were seen as sort of second-class citizens. Mm. And so a lot of the history of the First Nations people, the what you call Indians here in Manitoba and the French and the Métis people was sort of pushed under the rug just because we were dominated by the English people.
Yeah.
So we learned about it afterwards. But yeah, Lajimodière, there's a street and buildings named after him here. He's a hero, local hero. So this is sort of the lore. But yeah, the Manitoba, North Dakota, that northwest angle, that whole area wasn't what it is today. It wasn't Manitoba. It wasn't Minnesota. It wasn't North Dakota. It was the northwest. It was just this vast,
wild country. Territory.
Yeah. Oh, it was. I mean, they hunted buffalo just, you know, right here. Do you know where like Pembina, North Dakota is and all that? That was buffalo country.
Yeah.
That, you know, and now it's completely different. But
yeah,
there's a really strong connection and there's all kinds of French connections there. So it doesn't surprise me that you have French blood in you at all.
Yep. Yeah. We see definitely a lot of French. And then if you're up around in northern Minnesota, you'll see lots of Finnish, Scandinavian, you know, road
and
names.
Icelandic.
And exactly.
Yeah. My mother's family's from Iceland and she has relatives in Duluth, actually, in that area. Yeah.
Small world. Yeah. I've always thought it is, I guess, you know, I grew up here, so it's not like I chose to live here, but I enjoy many things about it. And Minnesota's and where you are too, you know, sort of edge of the boreal forested country, and then the prairie, you know, it's a pretty big transformation that we're kind of sitting on.
We live in a transition zone. So if I go east of Winnipeg, if I go an hour east of Winnipeg into our forests, I'm basically in the exact same stuff as you guys have there. It wouldn't look any difference except far fewer logging roads. There's much less logging up here. There is some, but it's not like down where you're at because there's just a lot fewer people. The population is a lot lower.
Yeah.
But it looks the same. But what we're at the very edge of woodcock country, of woodcock range. Mm. In fact, in some years, if the conditions here in Manitoba are ideal, we'll have woodcock, like in good numbers. But it was only recently that we were allowed to hunt them. Prior to that, woodcock were unknown here. People really didn't hunt them. They weren't in the game regs. People
when you
sort
say
of
recent,
them.
How recent?
So when I was hunting deer, let's say in my early 20s, so we're talking, you know, 40 years ago, I remember seeing the first woodcock. I was coming out of a deer stand at dusk. And what I thought was a bat flew in front of me.
Yeah.
And I went to my uncle and I said, I thought I saw a bat. And he said, no, he says, I saw something similar. I looked in a book. He says, here, I think it's one of these. It's a woodcock. So growing up, I didn't know what a woodcock was and nobody I knew hunted them or knew what they were. Slowly but surely, the population here, I think, has been on the increase. Mm. And over the years, the Manitoba Wildlife Federation and hunters have sort of lobbied to let's open a season on them. And I think it was no more than 10 years ago, but probably 8 or 9 years ago or something like that, that we finally got a season on them. And now every year it's our favorite thing to hunt. And like I say, in a good year, when things are perfect, we have good numbers of woodcock up here. In certain years, we have fantastic numbers. But because we're at the edge, if anything is less than perfect, if it's not just the right, you know, spring, the right summer, the right temperatures all throughout, we'll have literally zero woodcock. I've had a couple of years where we've never seen a single bird, no matter where we go in the province, because we're right at the extreme end of their range. And so they basically stay around you. And some of them come north. And I've seen them up to 200 miles north of Winnipeg. I've seen them almost on the Saskatchewan border, northwest of Winnipeg in some years. But then in other years, not a feather, nothing.
Wow.
So it's very spotty that way.
What about sort of unplanned on the podcast this month? We've been doing kind of a woodcock theme because of this weird lack of winter that you and I were chatting about before we hit record. And I had made it to Duluth as of a couple of weeks ago. Have you been out and about enough to at all to know whether the woodcock had made it up to you within the last week or so?
I have not been out, to be honest with you. There's still so much snow on the ground. I can't imagine. even if they were, I don't know where they're going to find food. We do have a
boatload of... So you did get some snow this year.
We did. We have it, and it's melted, but it melted to ice, really. So it's just covered everything. And so this year was unusual in that normally between the 10th and the 15th of March is when we see the first geese.
Okay.
We saw them around the 15th of February. The geese were 1 month early this year. And now in Winnipeg, I would estimate 50,000 geese in the city right now. It's insane. This is one of the first winters I know that we've seen numbers of ducks and geese overwintering here because the ice didn't freeze up.
Right.
Which was bad news for the ice fishermen, because it was hard, you know, trucks were going through the ice and whatnot on the lake.
Yep.
But I don't know if the woodcock are back, to be honest with you. We usually go out around this time a little bit later to listen for the snipe. I don't know if you are familiar with snipe or what they sound like when they winnow.
I don't know. I don't know if I've heard them winnow.
I bet you have, and most of the listeners probably have, but they didn't realize it was snipe. So I'm going to try and imitate it. I'm not very good at it. But what they do is they fly very high up in the sky to stake their territory. And what they'll do is they'll fly up and then they'll spiral down. And as they spiral down on these sort of dives, their tail feathers, the terminal feathers on their tail, will spread out and the last one will start vibrating. And it makes a sound that goes like this. That's kind of what it sounds like. So if you go to any wet area, you'll have them. I can almost guarantee you have them. Go to a place where they're here.
Yep.
Go to a place where it's wet and there's dogwood, basic woodcock cover, but the edge near fields.
Yeah.
Flooded out pastures are perfect for that stuff because they nest in trees and in fields. They don't nest in a marsh necessarily.
Yep.
And go there, especially in the morning or the evening, and just sit, and you'll hear that little sound. And look, just keenly look, and you will eventually see the tiniest dot in the sky, and that's the snipe just circling.
So, would you regularly see, like, if you could see and hear woodcock sky dancing, might you hear snipe as well? Like, do they overlap in that way?
Yes, okay. But I've rarely heard them overlap, although I have shot a left and right double. Once in my life, I shot a left and right double. The left was a woodcock, the right was a snipe.
They come out of the same
patch of woods. Yeah, yeah, it was amazing, and I have witnesses. So,
yeah. You know,
and my dog fetched them both for me. It was an amazing thing, but that was during an extremely wet year where the forest edges where the snipe liked to sit had enough water, and the woodcock were just slightly higher, and so, yeah, it all worked out.
Yeah.
But that was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. But so this time of year, that's what we do. We go out more or less to listen to it. I record them. I record the sounds of snipe because I love that sound. In fact, I could even add one at the end of this.
If you got a good audio clip, you should send it over.
I'll find a way to work it in. I have an audio clip and some video clips of it, you could just barely see them. And I have photographs of them as well. So I can send that to you at the end, yeah. But as for woodcock, I don't know. I mean, we don't go out. So from about end of April, early May, we don't go to the field. There's no law in Manitoba that says you can't train or run your dogs.
Gotcha.
But we just don't. We run them in dog parks and take them to fields where we know there are no birds. We leave the birds alone to nest.
Yeah.
And then go back out in August.
Yeah, I'm quite certain I have heard that sound. Usually my attention is probably on the painting or the woodcock, but I've got a friend locally that he lives right on the edge of a big alder swamp and not much for fields around. So I don't know if there would be a ton of snipe in there, but we'll go out and listen to the woodcock sky dancing and probably.
If you got a willow stand or dogwood or red osier dogwood, that classic stuff. But if it borders, let's say a cow pasture, that's perfect territory for it.
Perfect. Yeah.
That's where you're going to want to go and you'll hear them. Yeah. Cause they nest in whatever woodcock forest you find, they're at the edge of that.
Right.
They'll be there.
It makes sense. I feel like most of my recollection of snipe are I'm going down a trail and it's a wet year. Like I'm thinking of a wet year. There's puddles in the trail and this bird will get up in front of me and it's obviously very woodcock looking, but you can tell right away they just do not fly the same way. And they're so quick to get up and take off that I'm always like, oh, that's a snipe. And I don't even think to shoot at them really.
Oh, well, you know, we didn't either. So growing up, I saw snipe all the time. We would walk from my mom's family lives on the edge of Lake Winnipeg, or they used to live there. And we would walk from their farmhouse across pastures to go into the Lebo Marsh, basically the Netley Marsh, to hunt ducks. And I would flush a dozen snipe on my way there. You know, they'd scare the bejesus out of me when I was going in the morning, you know. But I never shot one because they were totally legal birds. You could do it. But, you know, my uncles or my dad would say, well, what are you wasting a good old shotgun shell for that tiny bird when you can shoot a goose or a mallard, you know? So I never did until my French friends started coming here. When I wrote my first book, I traveled a lot in Europe and I would invite people here afterwards to come hunt with us. And my friend, who's a avid snipe hunter, and snipe in Europe, and especially in France, if you can get a field trial champion dog, if you can get a championship title on your dog on wild snipe, that's the Rolls Royce of that. That's the best trophy in your trophy case because they're wild birds. They're very hard to point. There's not a lot of them. And my buddy might see a dozen or so per year in a season, you know, and he might shoot. He came out here, we're in a flooded field and they're popping up like popcorn all around him. The guy almost lost his mind. He's like, oh my God. And so I said, well, what's the big deal? He goes, oh, these are snipes. So he let his dogs out. He said, listen, I'll show you how. And his dogs were just slamming on points on these snipe. A couple got up, we shot them. And he said, okay, afterwards, I'm going to show you how to cook them. Yep. So we took them home and he showed me how to cook them. And that was it. One bite, I was a snipe hunter. And to this day, they are my favorite bird to hunt. They're my favorite bird to eat. They're just the best. Yeah, yeah, they're like, I compare them to, if a woodcock was a rough grouse, the snipe is the sharp tail. Basically, they're more open areas, you know, and they're a lighter, they're lighter colored. They're slightly smaller. They're lighter colored and the flesh is a little more delicate, as it were.
Okay.
Yeah, but they're brilliant. They're just awesome.
Yeah. Well, you got my curiosity's peaked now. If I don't recall, we've had the last couple of years have been very dry, so I don't recall seeing as many snipe in the last couple of seasons, but
when it's dry, they'll stick to the duck marshes.
Sure.
So you'll see them in a duck blind. You'll see them buzzing around or maybe even landing somewhere near you on a mud flat. And we never shoot them there simply because they're hard to find and you don't get a point. But when things are perfect here, when we have flooded pastures, flooded cow pastures, basically the cows replace the bison. So that's where we find sharptails and that's where we find snipe. Sharptails are there when it's dry, when it's super wet. If you need to wear rubber boots to cross a pasture, that's snipe country, or that's snipe conditions. Yeah.
Makes sense.
Well, snipe used to be a very popular game bird in North America. In fact, there were field trials held in the East on snipe. There were several field trials in the late 1800s that were like snipe championship trials, like in places like in New England. And a lot of the old photographs, I have several in my book, where I indicate that setters were considered retrievers. They were considered versatile dogs. They were considered upland pointing dogs, but they also were expected to retrieve. No American hunter back then thought they wouldn't. They thought, well, of course they're going to retrieve. And a lot of the old Currier and Ives photographs and the old lithographs that were on calendars and on, you know, in books show setters retrieving. And a lot of the birds they're retrieving very often are either woodcock or snipe.
Very interesting. All right. So you being the history guy, what's the story behind the snipe hunt, you know, the commonly used mythical snipe hunt? Like where do we cross over?
The snipe hunt, I got to be honest with you, I never heard about it before until the first time I heard about the snipe hunt was, I think, an episode of Cheers.
right. Yeah, it's used in media so much.
Right. Like, so I don't know about it. All I know is that snipe hunting was huge, and it is still huge in many countries, in the States and in Canada. People just don't do it anymore. I don't know why, because it's just so much fun. Delicious birds, very, very challenging for a dog. In fact, a lot of dogs will not, won't point snipe. You know how some dogs don't fetch woodcock just for some reason? There's some dogs that just refuse to. Well, it turns out that some dogs just will never, no matter. They could be the most brilliant pointing dog in the world to point everything except snipe. All mine have. I've been lucky. It didn't take them long. In fact, the first time I started hunting snipe, my dogs were already well-versed in hunting, you know, grouse and other, you know, and woodcock. But as soon as I shot a few snipe for them and had them fetch them, they figured, oh, okay, you want me to point these, and they were able to do it. But I have seen some dogs that just run right past them, run right over them, just have nothing to do with them. So it's a tough bird. And to shoot, can I swear? I'm sorry. Oh, shoot.
Go ahead.
If you're hunting snipe and if you hit our average, to be honest with you, our average with snipe is about 1 in 10 shots.
Yeah. They're kind of a dipsy doodle flight pattern.
they say when they, the major problem is you shoot too soon. What you should do is count to two and then shoot.
Okay.
But sometimes they flush at 30 or 40 yards. Like, they're very hard, very difficult bird. Yeah. They're much harder than a woodcock. They're, I would say that they're on par with sharp-tailed grouse, actually, or even more difficult in terms of pointing, and certainly more difficult to shoot. They're hard to shoot. The only difference is that typically your shot is in the open. You're not shooting like a woodcock. You're not shooting through wood.
Yeah, but that's, I think just, again, I've had so few instances where I've even thought about shooting because I think they're just so quick to get up and get out of there. They get up before I'm expecting them to, and I don't have dogs on point, so it's I'm caught by surprise to begin with. But and they're a very narrow, you know, they're a narrow target. They seem to, and I guess in my experience, like a woodcock, when it kind of does that helicopter up, like you've got a lot of visual, whereas that snipe is kind of more. It's always going straight away from me, and it's. You know, it's like a little silhouette, basically. There's not much to shoot at.
And if you're on the way to the duck blind, you're loaded with number threes or number twos. You know what I mean? Like, you need to shoot, like, we try and find steel sevens and seven and a halves to shoot them.
Because
they're a tiny bird. You don't need a lot. Or you don't need big shot. You just need a cloud of it. That's all.
What does good dog work look like on snipe? Are the dogs pointing them from pretty far off? Yeah. And then you're walking up? Like, what does that look like?
So I'm going to send you a video at the end of this. I have a video of my dogs hunting snipe with a buddy of mine.
Oh, cool.
And it shows them on point. And so as I mentioned, there are some dogs that'll never point a snipe. I don't know why. It's just some don't. And my friend, I translated a book from Italian called On the Bracco Italiano. It's a breed of pointing dog from Italy.
Yep.
And the fellow who wrote it is an old Italian guy. And he was an interesting fellow. He kept every litter he ever bred until all the pups were a year old. And he would only place them after a year. And he bred them since the 60s. I mean, the guy bred for 45, 50 years. So he has a ton. And he would specifically select his dogs to point snipe. He wouldn't breed a dog if it didn't naturally point snipe. So he developed a snipe line of Braccos. And so some dogs point them, some dogs don't. And among those that do point them, some are spectacular. And I have had the luck in my life to have, again, all of my dogs pointed snipe. But I had one in particular, a Weimaraner I got from Judy Balog, named Henri Henry. And my God, that dog, he was the snipe specialist and he would point them. And I'm not talking, you know, sort of slow down and then creep into a point. I'm talking like skid marks on the ground, slamming on point, but from a great distance, maybe 20 yards, 30 yards sometimes, like incredible. Wow. All my other dogs will point them slightly closer. And some dogs, even though they do point them, they don't quite get the hang of it. They'll get too close. They'll bump them or things like that. But when you get a good snipe dog, there's just nothing more spectacular in my mind because you're in open fields. You can see everything and you can watch the dog and Henry would run big. He'd be out there 200-300 yards, 400 yards sometimes. And he would just, boom, just slam. And again, I have a video of him. Yeah. And when he got super close, if he was too close, he would actually sort of crouch down because he knew he was that close. But I have some point. I have some video of him pointing snipe, and it's just the best. But
it's
a lot like everything else. But and there's singles. I don't ever recall. Yeah, maybe once in a blue moon you'll get the dog on point, and two will come up. You have one come up and another one 15 yards. But they're not covey birds. They're usually singles that come up right where the dog is pointing. If you got a good dog,
yeah. Man, well, I wasn't expecting to go so deep into snipe hunting, but I love it, Greg.
I'm on a mission. I'm on a mission to promote it. It's just the greatest sport in the world.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I wonder if that's not so clearly, and I think, you know, if you've been around pointing dogs enough, you kind of know, like, they have different dogs have different relationships with different birds, aka scents. And I've seen that with my own dogs. They behave a little bit, even if it's not necessarily like that they won't pick up a woodcock, but it's just a woodcock is a different bird to them. And I wonder, you know, with pointing dogs, and we're going to talk about the history of pointing dogs today, like how much, obviously there's lots of, it's this really unique story in this human shaping and molding of these dogs and in these breeds. When it comes to the birds, I mean, is it really, you know, does it really require that specific level of breeding and selecting to hunt specific birds? And then how do you compare that to just a dog that hunts, you know, I think ideally we want them to hunt and treat all game birds the same way, but clearly there's some differences. Is there any reasonable way to think about that?
As I mentioned before, the guy who wrote the book on the Braco Italiano, his name is, in English, it would be Cesare Bonasegali, Cesare Bonasegali in Italian. So he came to the conclusion that any pointing dog of any breed will point to partridge. They all will. It's just, you know, there are certain breeds named after partridge. In other words, a partridge dog is how some European countries or languages say bird dog. They don't say bird dog. They say partridge gotcha. Dog. And that just yeah. simply means a dog that points. You know, even in some of the old German texts, you'll see Hönehund, which is Hun hound or a chicken bird, or I'm sorry, chicken dog. That yeah. that was the old name for them.
Hun hound. I like that.
Yeah, Hönehund, Hund. And the Dutch breed, so the Drent partridge dog or the Drent Patrijshond is what they say in my terrible accent. But Perdiguero in Spanish and Portuguese, Perdiguero is from Perdix or the Latin Perdix, which is partridge. So, you know, pheasants, partridge, I would say to a certain extent, woodcock and other birds. For him, and again, this is a fellow with decades and decades of experience breeding, specifically selecting dogs for snipe. He came to the conclusion that the only one that, 99% of pointing dogs are not genetically programmed to point is snipe for some strange reason. I don't know. Hmm. And I got to say that snipe is the only bird I've ever seen a dog run past a dead one. So I've shot snipe with really good snipe dogs, and they've pointed these birds, and they'll point them to, you know, the cows come home. I drop it in the field, and I've seen that same dog see the bird fall. It falls into the grass and run literally over top of it. I have video of this. I have a video of a dog running over top of the bird and then coming back and forth a couple of times before it could, oh, there it is. So my theory, and it's just, you know, only that, is that snipe probably smell so much like their environment. They smell like mud. They smell like what they live in and eat, the worms, that it's very hard to distinguish them once they're down and dead. When they're living, I don't know, is it their breath? Is there something about them right. that the dog can detect? I don't know. But I've seen dogs point them and then be almost incapable of finding it once it's dead in the ground. And I've never seen that with any other bird, a grouse or partridge or a pheasant or whatever. It's right there. They pick it up.
Right.
But there's some reason. But yeah, I mean, certain breeds have been developed specifically for certain birds, obviously for yeah. the birds that are of their land. I mean, you look at the setters, the Irish setter and the English setter. I wrote in my book that these are unique breeds from a unique land hunting a unique bird, the red grouse. That is the classic field trial, the classic game bird for the English and Irish setter and the pointer are unique to the British Isles. There's a few of them over in Scandinavia related to them, but the British red grouse is something unique. And so it would be interesting to take a setter that's been removed for 150, 200 years from America, to remove from its native land and put them in its native land and see how they react.
Yeah.
And vice versa. So yeah, I mean, you know, they're developed by the culture, by the game and the terrain of their native land. So obviously that type of, in Africa, one of the fellows I was interviewing about pointers and setters in Africa, he was talking about game birds I'd never heard about, you know, Francolins. And
yep.
And there's these birds in South America. Some of the guys in Argentina were talking about perdiz.
Perdiz, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But then
yeah.
there's another one which isn't even related to any, it's not a galliform. It's not related to any of our game birds. It's a, what's it called? A timu. And it's some weird ass, almost roadrunner looking like bird that they hunt down there.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was, I just wrote an article for Hunting Dog Confidential about one of the first conservation dogs ever was in New Zealand. And there was this flightless type of parrot. It's a parrot, but it's like the size of a turkey, but it can't fly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it lives in New Zealand. And once the New Zealand sportsmen, you know, these English sportsmen going to New Zealand, they decided to bring rabbits in. Because they wanted something to shoot. Well, of course, the rabbits multiplied like rabbits.
There's no and predators.
They started, and so they said, okay, we need a predator. So they introduced weasels. And the weasels figured, hey, we don't have to go for these rabbits. They're too fast. How about these flightless, massive turkey-like birds, parrots? So they started decimating the entire colonies. And there was a very forward-thinking, conservation-minded fellow who trained his dogs to find these birds so that he could capture them. and remove them to another island. So he actually started a program that eventually saved those birds.
Relocated them. Yeah.
Yes, but he had to train his dog that, okay, this is the particular species of bird I want you to find, and I'll capture it and we can move it. Yeah, otherwise, I mean, the game and the terrain do form the types of breeds we have, but most pointing dogs will point almost anything that has feathers if you train them to do it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and we can see how with the genetics and the natural development, but like we can see how we can mold behavior. So it's not a huge leap to imagine that over time you could develop that instinct to point those flightless parrots or anything else for that matter.
Yeah. And I mean, so here's
bombs,
another
drugs,
example.
All of it, yeah. Right?
Oh, you know, pythons and different beetles in different trees. They can, you know, cancer on people. They can, you know, detect it on our skin now.
Right.
But, you know, you think about it. So in Ireland, snipe hunting is a huge thing. And there's an international snipe championship for red setters, for Irish red setters.
Wow.
So there are teams from around the world that bring their red setters who've already won trials in their country. And they go once every year or two to this huge trial in Ireland on the moors, on snipe moors. And so you got to figure that those dogs there come from parents who had won snipe trials, who come from parents who had won snipe trials. Mm-hmm. Genetically, there's got to be something going on there. It's the same thing with grouse dogs. I mean, New England grouse dogs, you know, that are famed for their abilities to handle grouse, or the dogs down south with bobwhite quail.
Yeah.
So that has to be a factor. But then again, you take a champion grouse dog, cover dog, you know, from grouse lines forever, and put him on pheasants, he'll be great. Or, you know, or put him on bobwhite, he'll be great too. Yeah. Great dogs are great dogs, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, and if it doesn't happen on day one, you know, give him enough time and, yeah, probably figure it out. Oh, that's, man, so many different directions to go. and I know, so this is a huge question, but I feel like I got to ask it. So can you give us an overview of the origins of pointing dogs? And I guess my main question for you, as somebody that has gone in and done the research and done a deep, is there like a point in time where we say, yes, this was the birth of pointing dogs, or is it a little bit more open to interpretation?
There are several things in history that you can look at that were all sort of invented around the same time. In other words, we say that so-and-so invented, you know, the light bulb. Edison invented the light bulb. Well, if you look into the history of the light bulb, there were a lot of things that, you know, sort of all happened at the same time, and he wasn't the only one with that idea. There were other people who invented things that were very similar to his light bulb, because they all sort of had figured out electricity, and they all figured out things start to glow, and, you know, all those reasons. Photography, for example. Photography was invented at the more or less the same time in France and in England independently. There was two guys working on it, two different versions of photography, but they both sort of figured out what was going on. And when we look at pointing dogs, we can see that there was this slow evolution in various areas almost concurrently with the improvement of arms once crossbows were there, with improvements in just sort of lifestyle. All of a sudden, things were changing in certain parts of Europe as well as around the world, but where pointing dogs really sort of took hold first, they were changing economically, culturally, where people had a little bit more time, a little bit more free time, a little bit more disposable income. They weren't, you know, suffering from plague yet, and they weren't, just living in caves, just trying to make a living or trying to, you know, put food on the table. There was a lot of different things were happening at the same time that allowed this birth of the pointing dog as we know it today. There isn't one person or one specific place that we can point to and go, that guy had the idea. But the idea took hold after many, many years of observing dogs and using them for various things, and then all of a sudden having the technical means of capturing birds, because dogs were used to capture birds for millennia. The idea that the paws, in other words, if we want to get back to where a pointing dog was created, we have to get back to this idea that we've known since we were cavemen that everything, including people, paws before you strike. And the example I give in my first book is swatting a mosquito. Just imagine a fly lands on your arm or a mosquito lands on your arm. Nobody just swats it. You wait and then you dive. You go for it. So even humans, quote unquote, point. Foxes do. You watch a fox locate a mouse under the snow and he jumps, and coyotes, everything. A cat. The pause before the leap is just almost a universal thing for predators, right?
Yep.
The stalk, the pause, the leap. We knew that. But it was of no use to us for many, many years because you didn't actually want that. You wanted that dog to go in and flush that covey into the net. You wanted that dog to go and flush that bird so your hawk could dive down and grab it. You didn't want any of that hesitation unless you were handling a specific type of dog. And that specific type of dog is called a limer or lemur or limier in French. And that specific type of dog, you would have been working as a dog handler for a rich dude. And that rich dude, he had the right to hunt everything on his property. Nobody else did. So there was a million deer, and he had the right to hunt them. And he had all the dogs he needed to hunt them. How was he going to hunt them today? Well, we're going to use these guys to run them until they're exhausted, and then we're going to use these guys to catch them and bring them down. Or let this whole pack run them, and then I'm going to go stick them with a spear. He had a variety of ways. But he didn't want any deer. He didn't want just any deer that happened across him. He wanted the big stag. He wanted the biggest brute of the whole thing. And they would identify the one out of the 10 that had the huge racks. That's the one. So we need to find that one. That's the one we're going to do. So we're going to use a limier, a limer. You or me, the dog handler. And you've got a limer. So what's your job? Your job isn't to have a dog that's going to bark and chase a deer. You want a silent dog, okay? So pointing dogs generally don't bark when they hunt. They're silent. They're silent dogs. And you want a dog that's very cooperative with you, that is sort of really connected to you. In fact, he's on the end of a leash. And you want a dog that's going to find that particular deer by scent, and he's not going to flush it. He's simply going to stop and go, yeah, it's right over there, boss. So these dogs were selected from a pack of hounds. You would have a pack of 100 hounds, and you go, that's the calmest, the quietest one, the one that doesn't bark, the most cooperative one. I'm going to train him so that when there's a deer close by, the one I want, he's going to stop, and he's not going to bark at it. He's not going to jump at it. He's not going to do it. He's just going to stop, and he's going to maybe give me some side eye. Boss, he's right over there, right over there. And so eventually, you've got dogs that are doing that. Naturally, they're starting to pause a little bit more. You get yourself a crossbow, and there's all these little partridge over there that you were always, you know, netting or trying to capture in traps or sort of lure into other things or herd into little, you know, cages. Well, what if my dog would actually stop? Maybe when I tell him to, I'll train him at first, go, oh, you see him over there, stop dog. Literally, stop dog. That's basically what a dog, a pointed dog is called in French or Italian or Spanish. Just point, stop. And then you'd shoot them on the ground. So the short-haired pointing dogs came from the limier or that limer, that those old hounds that would stop at the presence of a deer. That was seen as something valuable. Let's see if we can translate it to birds. The setters come from spaniels, which were originally flushing dogs that were trained. Nope, don't flush them. I want to get a shot at them. In fact, some of those they observed that some of them had the natural tendency to stop when they saw or smelled birds. And other ones had a natural tendency to circle them. So in the oldest book on pointing dogs, one of the oldest books written in Spain, the guy said there are two types of dogs, perro de punta, pointing dogs. There's two types, he says. There's the pointing dog and the circling dog. He said, some dogs will just point. And he said, other dogs will circle like a border collie around a herd of sheep. He'll circle. And he said, sure. The best of them are the ones that do both. That under certain circumstances, they'll point. And under other circumstances, they'll actually circle the dog. I had a friend who had an English setter that would circle birds. And he hated it because it wouldn't win a trial. And he tried to train it out of them.
Right.
And I didn't know any better at that time. But after reading that, I realized, no, he that was what some of them did. Eventually that went out of style and just the pointing dog was there. And at first they had to train them, especially the long-haired breeds, the spaniel and setter breeds, which eventually gave rise to the setters. The long-haired ones got to England first and they needed a lot of training. In fact, certain trainers would specialize in taking dogs and training them to stop in the presence of birds. One of those trainers became really famous in that he trained a pig to do it. He said, I could train anything to do it. Oh, wow. And there's a very famous story about the pointing pig. He said, of course, it's trained watch. And he trained a pig to point. And that pig naturally backed other dogs. He would actually hunt with this pig. Wow. Yeah, if you just Google the pointing pig and there's all kinds of stories. There's actually illustrations of it. It was a big old sow that he trained.
No kidding.
And it was huge. And they made, yeah. And eventually when that dog's or that pig's career was over, they made a bunch of bacon out of it, unfortunately.
Well, that's one way to go.
Yeah, but check out the pointing pig. I'm going to put it up. I have on my blog, I have the whole history of the pointing pig. But
this is way back 1600s.
No, that was in the 1800s, actually. The guy did it just to prove a point. that anything will can be trained to point. But what they wanted was, and so some of these long-haired pointing dogs, which eventually became the setters, some of them did have a natural point, but it wasn't super strong. Some of them it was, but most of them they trained. And in fact, even if it did have a natural tendency to point, they would train it anyway. Just like we force break retrievers, like, you know, a lab, he wants to retrieve, but they'll force break him anyway just to get it solid, right? They used to do that. And then the short-haired pointing breeds came over from France and from Spain. They come to England. And the very first time the English saw these dogs, they were kind of amazed because for, you know, 100 years, they'd have to been training their long-haired dogs to point. Now, all of a sudden, these short-haired dogs come over and they point naturally. So the very first description of a pointer in England, the author says, new to our shores is a dog that we call the natural pointer. That was the name of the breed or the type of dog at first. Pointers were called natural pointers because they did it naturally. They didn't have to be trained so much. And then, so to get more natural point into setters, they crossed them into setters. They put some pointer blood into setters and then back and forth over the years. And that's basically how we got pointing dogs. In Europe, the same thing happened. They just saw naturally pointing dogs and bred from them. To the point now where you'll take a little 8-week-old pointer or setter pup or brack pup, wave that little, you know, feather in front of them on a wing on a string, and they're doing it. Yeah. But that wasn't the norm 500 years ago. 500 years ago, that was an unusual dog that did that. And you trained all the others.
Yeah, anybody running dogs today is benefiting from all of that selection and genetic development.
Gearing up for your next hunt? Check out Ugly Dog Hunting Company for all your dog supply needs. Ugly Dog Hunting carries a full line of products for your bird dog and even some for you. Whether you're looking for dog collars, GPS tracking devices, kennels, beds, leads, training equipment, or first aid supplies, Ugly Dog Hunting carries it and a whole lot more. New owner of the company and friend of the Birdshot podcast, Mike Nadusky, loves to remind me that while I do hunt with pretty dogs, every dog can be an ugly dog. Check out the entire selection of gear for you and your bird dog at uglydoghunting.com. For many upland hunters, along with their passion for dogs, birds, and the places we chase them, comes a passion for shotguns. Upland Gun Company specializes in customizing shotguns for the upland bird hunter, imported from Italy and shipped direct to an FFL near you. Select from one of their side-by-side or over-under shotgun platforms and customize the fit, function, and aesthetics to your liking. Design and build your next upland hunting shotgun with Upland Gun Company today. Visit uplandguncompany.com.
Yeah, and the running part was part of it as well. I mean, you know, not only does a pointing dog or is a pointing dog expected to point, a pointing dog is expected to run in a certain way, at a certain speed, at a certain distance. And that is the biggest sort of factor in terms of how they differ from one region to another. Some region wants them slower because it's hotter than hell and you don't want that dog blazing through everything. There's no water. You want to hunt all day. So you train them to, or you breed them to trot. Other places, the moors of England and very vast open areas, you want that dog a dot on the horizon. And you want it to go fast and with a ton of style because you're a rich dude. And you don't want just game in the game bag. You want to impress your visitors. You want to impress those other rich dudes that are hunting with you. So you better have some really stylish rocket dogs out there to blow their minds, not just to put game on the table. So it's the running part, really. It's the running, it's the search and the style part that is even more, the universal is pointing. All cultures who develop a pointing dog wants them to point, but it's how they run, how they find game, and then what they do after the point. That's really a difference. Here in North America, my dog runs at whatever speed or range it points. Our tradition here is now that that dog is pointing, its job is kind of over for now. Until I send it to fetch. Now it's pointing. I go out in front of that dog, or the gun goes out in front of that dog and stomps around and flushes the bird. Ideally, the dog stays steady. You shoot the bird, it's released, it fetches. The Europeans and the English think we're crazy for doing that. When they see videos of North American field trials and the handler's out in front of the dog, they say, "What's he doing? A rain dance? Like, why is he out there?" They have no clue why we would not let the dog tell us exactly where the birds are and move towards them to help flush them and remain steady. Mm-hmm. So how they get to the point, their style on point, and what they do after the point is all culturally dependent. It differs from one country to the next and one region within to the next.
So I'm definitely familiar with the idea that we're kind of Americans are unique in the, we want our pointing dog on point. Yeah. And I'm going to go in and flush the bird. What do you know of, and have you been around it? Like, I have English setters. And so if you have an English setter on point, are they giving a command to then go flush? And then are the dogs like kind of racing in and flushing it like a flushing dog? Or is there variation to how they would do that as well?
Yes, there's a great variation. So there's a variation and a difference between. So what you need to understand is that North America is one of the few places in the world that doesn't differentiate between pointers and setters, the breeds from Britain and Ireland and all of the ones from the continent, right? They're sort of two great families of the pointing dog world. That's why I did my books here. You can see them in two volumes.
Yep.
Volume one is about all the dogs from the, there you go. That's volume two. So volume one is all the dogs from Europe, 30 some odd breeds. Volume two is about the dogs from Britain and Ireland. And the Europeans and the British also divide them. So to answer your question, it depends on what the breed is. I'm going to talk about what happens in England. It is a continental breed. And this also happens in Scandinavia. If it's a continental breed, what they want is a forceful flush. The dog searches, it points, the handler gets up, the guns are on either side, because typically the handler, the guy who's handling the dog, let's say on the moors, isn't shooting. They do sometimes, but generally he's there for his customers. They're his clients. Sure. So he places the guns. He says, okay, gun, you go over here to the right, you go over here to the left. And then he says to his dog, now I'm talking a continental breed. This is a GSP, it's a Vizsla, it's a Weimaraner, it's a GWP. And he says, get in there, get in. And that dog, like a spaniel, who was on point, but he just rushes in, the bird up, the dog sits. The dog doesn't chase, obviously, he just sits like a spaniel. Bird is up, boom, shot. He's sent for the retrieve. Now, that's a continental breed. You could be on the exact same moor with the exact same handler, and he's running pointer and setter. It's different. The pointer and setter, this is how they work. And this is how all pointing dogs will work in places like France and Italy and Spain. Dog's running around, goes on point. Guns are put in position. Now, instead of the handler saying to the dog, get in there and forcefully flush them, he clicks his fingers. He doesn't actually say anything to him. He gets beside the dog and he might click his fingers or not say anything. And he or she and the dog together move very slowly towards the birds. And the pointer or setter remains in the pointing position. They're like a panther stalking.
Yeah.
And they move slowly, 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 slowly till the bird's up. Bird's up, the dog remains, doesn't move. Now the handler says, okay, keep going. This process is called working out the ground. They're hunting red grouse, which are often in coveys like our sharptails. So you got three that flush, there might be four more still sitting there. And if all of a sudden you release the dog and it flushes more, well, your guns haven't had time to reload yet. You've kind of ruined it.
Yeah.
So basically what they want the dog to do is to flush. In an ideal world, that dog would move forward, two or three bird gets up, boom, boom, they fall. He moves forward again, two or three more fly, boom, boom, they fall. Two or three more get up after and boom, boom. And that would be seen as an ideal situation. That dog has done his job. He's given those shooters plenty of time and opportunity to shoot birds. And so that's the real difference is how they move forward. Sometimes it's a forceful flush, depending on the breed and the game. And other times it's moving forward. Now, in North America, what we love is it doesn't matter how far I get in front of that dog, it ain't moving.
Right.
If that English handler has a dog, and he's got his customers, he's got his clients on either side, and they're waiting to shoot. And that dog doesn't move with him, he's red-faced, embarrassed. He's mortified.
Yeah.
That dog is called sticky. And a sticky dog is like the worst sin you can have. Because those grouse are probably running in front of you. Those grouse are moving. You need a dog that sticks with the handler, that stays with the handler, and he figures out, he works out that situation. If that dog, and I've seen it at trials, the handler is, you can't, at a trial, you can't touch your dog. You can't really talk to it. You can't force it to move. And you see these handlers just mortified. Oh my God, my dog is sticky. And you see the judges scratching down in their little notepad. And you just know the whole thing has gone to
hell.
They
got the red pen out.
They got the red pen. It sucks. And so I'm looking at some of these dogs and they're magnificent and they're sticky. And I'm like, send them to me, dude. Right, I'll take that dog. That dog. In fact, the dog that doesn't want to move at all after a point, that's what we want. They hate that. They just do not want that. They want a dog that is what they call free around game, that isn't afraid to move with authority. He knows how far he can go or how close he can get, and no more. And those dogs that are really clever like that, they're highly valued. Other dogs will go too fast or too close and flush the bird. They don't like that either. But that dog who gets it mastered, they're seen and you know, held in high regard.
Yeah. So you, having seen these variations, and it, you know, totally makes sense. You know, we're going to develop these dogs to do things a little bit differently, and it's not a huge leap to imagine that not everybody's going to look at it the same way. But you sort of still like the sticky dog, and is that like due to your hunting or trialing, or like could you hunt with a free dog and be happy with it?
So when I say, you know, a sticky dog, send it to me, what I mean is send it to guys like me in North America. When I first started hunting, and for the first sort of, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, I did exactly like everybody in North America. I walked in front of my dogs, and I can remember being 30, 40 yards ahead of my dog on sharp tails. And the dog is pointing, and I figure, oh, they must have gone to the left. So there I am stomping off to the left. Meanwhile, 30 yards to my right, they all flush. I have no clue where those damn birds are. My dog does. He could have shown, he could have led me exactly to where they are because his nose is telling him. So for many years, I did that. And in my view, the North American tradition of doing that, because we didn't always used to do that. You read reports of the very first field trials in Memphis, Tennessee, and in the southern U.S., you read field trial reports, and they talk about their dog. It's called roding. So to road the bird, that's what the dog is doing. He's roding towards the birds. They did that in American field trials. It hasn't been that way since day one. We used to handle our dogs here in North America exactly how they do in England. Eventually that fell out of favor though, and I have a feeling it was because of bobwhite quail. Bobwhite quail tend to stick really tight and they don't scurry a lot. That's why they have like flushing whips, you know, like an actual whip that you go in this really tight bush and you have to literally flush these birds out. So using the English system, I figure maybe the dog could even catch them. I don't know. But I think that standing in front or moving in front of the dog to flush works perfect on quail. But on pheasants and sharptails and other birds, roughies, maybe not so much. So eventually, over time, I started using the European system more and more and more. So now when my dog is on point, I get beside my dog and move forward with it. You know, my wife will typically go over to my left or right and I'll say, okay, he's on point. I'll move the dog. And if I get the shot to one side or you get to the shot to the other, but my dogs move. And now when we hunt pheasants too, when that dog has got a bird nailed, I get in one side, my wife gets in the other side, and I tell my dog, oh, wait. And he goes in there and flushes them for me. Mm. Now, I'm not a good trainer, so my dogs aren't particularly steady. One of them, they're steady to wing more or less, but they're not steady to shot. As soon as the shot goes off, they run. But I find that for the game that I hunt, in the conditions that I hunt in, having a dog that's free around game, a dog that will in fact go and move when I tell it to. Listen, if my dog's on point, I could sit down and have coffee. Like we could do another podcast episode. He ain't moving.
Yeah.
They know they ain't moving until I'm beside them. And then I use the French word, which is cool. And I say to them, cool. And they know in a low voice and they move. They stalk. Like they don't start walking. They're in the same pointing position and they just keep moving.
They know they're in the presence of game and
Yeah. It's again, it only applies to me and I can't say that everybody should do that. But on the other hand, I can't say that everybody should have their dog never move off of point. It has to be effective for the way you hunt and what you do. And because I hunt almost always with my wife, it's almost always the two of us. I want to make sure we're with my nephew. Sometimes there's three of us. I want to make sure I know where everybody is. And that, okay, the dog is going to lead me to that bird. And I'm telling you, man, I've had some occasions where we've moved forward 25, 30, 40 yards until the bird's up. Yep. Otherwise, I wouldn't have even found the bird. And I don't know if you've noticed this with woodcock, but for me, just anecdotally, I think they're running more than they used to in the past. Or that's what the old timers tell me. Like I've actually seen them walking.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. I haven't hunted woodcock long enough to say it's more now than it was, but absolutely they do move and my dogs have relocated on. And See, I loved, I've really gotten into that conversation. And the interesting thing is, you know, really there isn't one way to do this. And I think that was the realization that I've sort of come to from talking to people, you know, there's a little bit, there's room in there to sort of develop a system of how you want to hunt dogs, right? Which maybe is obvious, but I think when you're just getting started in bird dogs, you're kind of like, all right, I don't want to mess this up. You know, what is this? What is the practice that I follow? And really one of my setters, my younger setter Rose, she is much more free on game, and to the point where I don't release, I just let her do what she wants to do, because over time I've developed such a high level of trust in her. Yes. I know she's not going to intentionally flush a bird.
Yep.
So I just let her do her thing, because as you're talking about, she is giving me the most information possible on these birds that are moving and running, be it a ruffed grouse or a woodcock, which is what we tend to hunt. And I can't see any other way I love that. It's thrilling to watch a dog do that.
Oh, you know, and I first started doing that when we first started hunting a lot of pheasants. Because there are certain areas where you simply can't move. Like, I can't get through that wall of cover.
Right.
My dog has to get in there for it. But it's the same thing with woodcock, you know, because we haven't been hunting woodcock for a long time. Again, they were not a legal game bird in Manitoba until about maybe 10 years ago or so. But my goodness, I mean, there are some areas where, you know, like, for me to get in where my dog is, I'd have to be on my hands and knees, you know, impossible. Yeah. No, it really does come down to the right situation or the right technique for you in your game or in your terrain on your game. And this whole idea, and the thing I think, one of the things that I learned most by doing, crawling down the history of all these breeds, this whole idea of, well, it's always been done that way, isn't really true.
Right.
It always seems to be about a generation or two. In other words, everything that we take for granted that's normal today was not particularly normal back in the day. I was just today finishing an article I'm writing called The Tale of the Tales. How did it come to pass that in North America we like the 12 o'clock tail? Was it always that way? Well, it wasn't always that way. It changed over time. And again, this approaching the bird with the handler wasn't always that way that we walk in front of the dog. It wasn't always that way. In the early days, it was the opposite. Pointers and setters don't retrieve. Was it always that way? No, they used to. Things change over time. And so by reading history, we can understand that at certain points in time, certain things were in favor and fell out of favor and other things came on. And so it really is up to us and every generation to reinvent the wheel for themselves and to reinvent our approach and our appreciation and our understanding of pointing dogs as it applies to us today. We need to honor the past. We need to understand the past. We need to honor the traditions that have been passed on to us. But ultimately, we are responsible for forming new traditions that we're going to pass on to others. So this whole idea of being free around game for our dogs, I think that we need to keep that attitude with ourselves. We need to be free around the ideas of hunting and the ideas around how we interact with dogs and interact with the game and the terrain that we're in today. Our ancestors did. The people who paved the way for us did. They weren't stuck in the past. They were pioneers. They were on the cutting edge of technology. You know, you go back and see these old films or read these old stories and they think, oh, how old-fashioned. Well, to them, they weren't old-fashioned. To them, they were the avant-garde. They were cutting edge, man. And so we can be too.
That's cool. All right, Craig. So what was your goal when you set out to, and obviously we've got Pointing Dogs, Volume 1 and 2. What year did Volume 1 come out?
2011.
Wow. Yeah, that's going way back.
I started it in 99. It took 12 years to write that book.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And I know you did a ton of travel before that, before that first book.
That was one of the main reasons because, you know, I was a commercial photographer and I ran a photography school and was a writer and that. And so, and my wife, you know, had a full-time job in a translation department. So, you know, we had to save our pennies every year and it would take us a long time to save enough money to travel to Europe. So every year-ish, we would go. Because when I set out to write the books, I decided I don't want to write them from secondhand knowledge. I don't want to, because a lot of stuff I had been reading prior to my book was written by people. It was clear. It was obvious they'd never seen that breed or they'd never been to that country or they couldn't read that language or original sources. So I figured, no, that's not the way I'm going to do it. If I'm going to write about the Hungarian Vizsla, I'm going to Hungary. I'm sorry. I'm going to go meet Hungarians and I'm going to go to Budapest and I'm going to figure this out. Same thing with the Spanish double nose pointer. I'm going to Spain. I'm going to see and photograph these dogs for myself. So that took a lot of time.
Straight from the source.
You had to, because I didn't have any, I wasn't an expert, but I knew how to find experts. You know, thanks to the internet and relatively inexpensive international travel, I was able to find people who spent their entire lives developing or breeding these dogs. So what better source of information than a guy that's been in them since the 60s or 70s, you know? Some of these people I met were just incredible. Dr. Dostal, a guy in Czech Republic who was basically the guy in charge of the Český Fosek, you know, started it in the 1970s, started with the breed in the 1970s under communism. He was under a communist regime in Czechoslovakia at that time. And being under communism in that when you were in charge, you were in charge. When you said jump, people said how high. So he was put in charge of a breed and had like unilateral power over the development of the genetics of that breed. And then I got to interview him. He was a geneticist. I mean, you know, they did a lot of bad things, the communists, but one thing they did right was put really smart people in charge of their dogs. And he was one of them. And so if I want to learn about the Český Fosek, this guy knows more about it than anybody in the world. So I sat down and spent an afternoon with the guy. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. When you first set out to do volume one, well, I guess this is my question. Were you just going to write the story of pointy dogs? And then at some point it became clear, I've got to do continental and then later we'll handle the British and Irish breeds, or how did that come about?
Yeah, so the first dog I got was a Weimaraner. I was lucky I got a good one. He was a good hunting dog. Loved him. And he just blew my mind. As soon as I got that dog, I didn't even know there were other breeds. I didn't know. I just sort of fell ass backwards into the breed and these dogs. And I thought, oh my God, I want to learn everything I possibly can about my dog, about his breed, and then all the other related breeds. I love traveling. I love, you know, photography, I love history, I love reading. And so it just made sense that my wife and I would just go down this rabbit hole and, you know, take this enormous journey to find out for myself. So I wrote my books for me. I just wanted to learn about them. And I wrote down my notes and just started writing. But what I realized very early on was that this is going to be a huge project. And if I was going to combine all the continental breeds and the British breeds in a single book, we're talking almost 1,000 pages. Okay. It would have been just too hard to handle. And in Europe, the FCI, the International Canine Federation, divides, as I mentioned earlier, there's two great families within the overall family of pointing dogs, continental breeds and the British and Irish breeds. So all over the world, except in North America, when you run a field trial, they're separate. Pointers and setters never run against GSPs or Britneys. In North America, we do, but they don't there because they're considered different groups. Almost like, you know, the sporting and the toy group here in the AKC, they're not together. They're not shown together. They're not trialed together. So I thought, oh, this makes sense. Why don't I just do two books? One, and then the next one on the British breeds. The first one took 12 years because, again, travel, and there were so many breeds and I had to translate so many different sources from different languages. And information was hard to find, to be honest with you. It started with the internet. Just when the internet was getting started is when I started writing. And finding information on a Český Fosek wasn't easy. You know, trying to, you know, get people to translate from Slovakian and Czech languages was not easy. And some of these breeds were really obscure. You know, the Majorcan pointer from the island of Majorca off the coast of Spain. Like, finding information was really hard. The second book, it was the opposite. With volume two, I thought, it'll take me 2 or 3 years. It took me another 10 years too, for the opposite reason, was because there was so much damn information.
Yeah.
I said, it was like trying to fill up, you know, trying to fill this glass here at the bottom of Niagara Falls. I mean, like, it was so hard, so much information, so much more available now, especially online, and all of it's in English. My goodness, it took me years just to, you know, sift through it all. And then, of course, we wanted to travel. And as we went to England, we went to, you know, all over Europe to see pointers and setters. And then COVID hit and all of our travel plans blew up. We couldn't travel anymore. So I decided, well, okay, I'll take the, you know, COVID time to sort of sit there and refine the book. and do a lot of the photography. In fact, one of the big differences between the first and second book, in the first book, all of the photographs are mine. 99% are mine. In the second book, just over half are mine. The other half are from people in other countries. Yeah. Because I couldn't go to Norway and Sweden. I couldn't get to South Africa. I couldn't, gotcha. You know, to Australia. So in the second book, it's only five breeds, but each one of those breeds is described around the world. So the English Setter is described in England. I talk about the history in America. I talk about English Setters in Australia and South Africa, France, Italy. Italy, where 20,000 Setters are born every year. You know, yeah. I mean, Italy is the capital of Setters in the world nowadays, English Setters.
How does that number compare to, like, do you have a number for the U.S. or North America?
Oh, it's crazy. It's crazy. And it's unknown outside of, well, it was something that shocked me when I first started describing it. Okay, let's start with England, the native land of the English Setter. In a good year, they'll have 300 pups. It's on endangered species list in England. It's on the vulnerable breeds list of the Kennel Club. They view it as a vulnerable breed. It might go extinct in England. When we were there, the average English person that we met in a pub, when we told them we were there to photograph English Setters, had no clue what that was. They didn't know what an English Setter was, or a pointer. Hmm. They didn't know. Gordon Setters, didn't know. So 300 in a good year, 350 maybe. In the U.S., we're talking 2,500, maybe 3,000 in a good year. Well, again, you can divide that between field bred and show bred and different types. But sure, yeah, we're talking in the low thousands, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, something like that, max.
Significantly less than 20,000 in Italy.
Yeah. There was, so the highest year in the last, let's say, 10 or 15 was 19,900 or something more. And then the lowest has been like maybe 15,000 puppies. Those are registered, right? Those aren't just the ones that are, like, there might be another, I don't know, it might be double that because of unregistered litters. Who knows?
Yeah.
But English Setters are, you like, just everybody and his dog has an English Setter in Italy. It is the breed, the dominant breed, and they breed unbelievable dogs that dominate the field trial scene. You cannot find a champion English Setter in anywhere in Europe that doesn't have a ton of Italian blood in it. They just, I don't know why. But they glommed onto that breed, they fell in love with it, and they just produce it like crazy, and really good ones too.
What is that you must know, and maybe it's, there's some big field trial, maybe there's a bunch of them, but is there where one sort of pinnacle event of in Italy trials for English Setters? I feel like somebody, a listener, has told me about it.
Yeah, so there's several different events for English Setters and pointers. And the one that I think that I would love to attend is one at a place called Campo Felice. Campo Felice is a big sort of a mountain plain, like it's a plain, but very high mountain plain in Italy, where every year all of the champion dogs, all of the best dogs get together so that people there can observe them in field trial like situation. It's not quite a trial, a traditional trial. There's released quail on the grounds. It's basically a display the best of the best. They get there and they run these dogs only for a few minutes each, but just so that everybody can see them and film them running and pointing. That's a huge one. It's called Campo Felice. And that is sort of, again, it's not necessarily the biggest trial, but it's more of a display than anything else. And then, of course, there's championship trials. And then in Europe, there's the European Championship, which I think is unbelievable. And I think that it'd be really cool to have something like that in North America or in the US. So the idea is this, it's almost like the Olympics, whereby each breed will select a team of handlers from their country and they'll go to the European Championship. So you'll go to the European Championship and, you know, Team France is represented by these six guys. And one has a Brittany, the other guy has a GSP, and the other guy has, you know, they have various dogs. And so in the Continental Stakes, you'll have the Italian team versus the French team versus the Spanish team or the Norwegians. So it's like the Olympics. They have teams that are selected in each country and they go and compete for the European Cup. And they do it with pointers and setters, and they do it with the continental breeds. So winning the European Cup would be a huge thing. And then you can become a field trial champion in your own country. So in Italy, you'll have a champion from Italy. But that champion can then go on and earn championships in other countries, and it becomes an international champion.
Oh, wow.
So in the States, it would be cool. Could you imagine, you know, where a team from the Northwest is competing against a team from the Southwest and the Southeast and the Northwest? You know what I mean? Like, you'd have four or five different regions of the country and all the best pointers from here, you know, the best pointers from the Northwest are going against the best pointers from the Southeast or something. You know, they all meet, I don't know, in Kansas, and they have a big old trial.
Like the Ryder Cup in golf, you know, you know, we would get behind that.
Yeah, it'd be like that, you know. So, but in order to get on that team, you've got to beat all the locals. You got to beat everybody in your region. And then it's like the top three handlers with the top three dogs from the Piney Woods in Georgia are going after the top three dogs in the North Woods. You know what I mean?
That would be fantastic.
That's what it's like. But what you have to understand is that the European field trial scene is ginormous. Like, they have trials with up to 500 or 600 dogs in the trial.
Gosh.
It takes 10 days to run the trial. And there's dogs from all over the world. And there'll be hundreds and hundreds of spectators watching these things. I mean, they're crazy mad about field trials out there. Like, they just, it's a whole other world, super hyper competitive, with a lot of money at stake. Like really, really, you know, expensive dogs with expensive handlers. And just they start in Spain in January, and the field trial circuit goes all the way up through France and then across all the way, you know, furthest east, like up to Poland and Serbia and Croatia. They'll have trials there all the way down to Greece. It's just crazy. And it's a wonderful thing to see too.
Yeah. I thought I could find the name of the event I was referencing in my text messages, but I can't confirm it. You might be onto it, but Hunter, if you're listening, send me a message. He's told me about it before.
If you want to find something that's really cool. Now, it's really hard. One of the things, whenever I recommend YouTube videos about pointing dogs, it's hard because I've videotaped them, and anybody who's tried to make a serious, good videotape of pointing dogs in action is really hard, because pointing dogs are at their best when they're 200 yards away from us at a, you know, flying like the wind. That's hard to film and have the handler in it or any context. So typically when you see videos of pointing dogs running, they're sometimes disappointing, but there are certain sequences and certain points of them where you get a real idea as to what it looks like. Because to see some of these dogs run in person, like I've seen, you know, there's lots of videos from the national championship from Ames Plantation. And I like watching them. They look really cool. But to be honest, they don't show the dogs at the best, because you want to get the horses and the handler in the same frame. So the dog really isn't necessarily that far. And nor do they always show the best scenes where that dog is just blazing a trail. You know what I mean? Sometimes you go, oh, that's kind of underwhelming. But when you see him in person, it's amazing. Like, the dogs are super fast and just really running, you know, full bore. It's the same thing with European videos. So if any listener here wants to see some of the European stuff, just type in YouTube, Campo Felice, F-E-L-I-C-E, and look at the latest ones. And they put some sort of techno music behind it, but it's just basically videos of dogs running back and forth across this big old field. And again, depending on the cameraman, depending on the angle, sometimes it'll look okay, but other times you'll see and you'll get an appreciation in terms of the sheer speed and style of these dogs. And what you want to look for is the difference. The Europeans really insist on pointers should run like pointers and setters should run like setters. So pointers should be very upright and running with a great amount of muscular energy. And they should look like, they say, like somebody stabbing with a sword. They should be thrusting. You should see this real powerhouse of a run. Setters should look like they're flowing over the ground. Their belly should never be more than a few inches off the ground. And any undulation in the ground, the setter should follow it. And so you'll see that in some of these videos. You'll see that, wow, the setters look completely different from the pointers when they run and point as well.
Yeah.
Whereas here, setters and pointers, the major difference is the length of the hair, really, in terms of their gait and how they run. I mean, there's more differences, but they're subtle compared to what there are over there.
Yeah.
But yeah, YouTube is your friend. Look up YouTube, look up Campo Felice or European Championship for Pointing Dogs in other languages. And you'll find lots of really cool videos.
Yeah. One of the coolest things about pointing dogs is them interacting with the bird. And it's because they're out there doing it, it's hard to capture that on camera. You know, I've kind of started wearing a GoPro for a lot of my hunts. I just sort of save the footage, but it's like when you get that moment. And you know this, like in the grouse woods, a lot of times you don't actually get to see the magic, but in once in a blue moon, when the dog points that bird close to you and I capture that on camera, you know, I mean, that is just that's some of the coolest stuff see, and it's hard to capture it.
Yeah, but seeing it in real life is the best, right? And so that's the other thing that I encourage anytime I'm given a public forum to speak in. I always encourage people to do two things. One is to look at where they hunt and how they hunt through different people's eyes. So I'm one for, I've done this over the years and I've had people from all over the place come and hunt with me. And what it's done is it's given me a brand new appreciation for where I hunt and what I hunt. You know, you grew up in the area that you're in, and a lot of people, they hunt in the area they grew up in, and they think that that's normal. In other words, I did.
Sure.
The way I hunted, I thought everybody around the world hunted like that. I thought, well, what do you mean you don't hunt like me? This is hunting to me. But when they came here and their eyes are as big as saucers, you know, like, oh, like, and they would freak out at things that I would sort of ignore, or I didn't even realize. I didn't even see some of these things. But through their eyes, I got a brand new appreciation. Oh my God, I am the luckiest guy in the world because I have X, Y, Z, and I'm here, and this is a great place. And then the other one is to go somewhere else to experience the way they hunt elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, even for me, I'm not that far from North Dakota or South Dakota. It's only a few hours, 8-10 hours or whatever from where I am. But seeing how people hunt down there, I had never seen, for example, hunting pheasants. You know, when you have a bunch of people walking through a field and then you have, what are they called? Blockers?
Blockers. Yeah. Yeah.
And what are the other ones called? Walkers or pushers?
I forget. No, I haven't done that a lot of myself.
I'd never seen that before. And it was fascinating. One day we came across a group of people that were waiting at the end of a field and I didn't know, I thought they were simply watching this guy combine his sunflower seeds. But what they were waiting for was him to do the last row because that's where all the pheasants were. And they knew,
piled up,
they knew that they were all going to come over them. And I thought, this is really cool. And and just the way that, you know, lay out blinds for duck hunting and stuff. So even a short distance from home, I can see completely different ways. And then going across the ocean to England or to France or Italy or, you know, all these different places to see different types of hunting. It's the most amazing thing that you could possibly do. And so I always encourage people to try and learn from other places. And if you can't afford, and I know it's expensive because I've been there and done that and I've killed several credit cards in the process. traveling is expensive, but a good way to do it is simply to invite someone from somewhere else to hunt with you in your own territory. And then do an exchange hunt, you know, and then go somewhere else to hunt. And then you learn so much from them and about their dogs and the way that they interact with them as well. It's great. It's a great experience.
All right. Couple more for you. We're gonna wrap this up. I've been dying to ask you this question. So English setters, I kind of have this, obviously I have too. And I have this idea in my head that like the setter, the English setter, there's so much variation within that breed as far as like size of dog and different hair coat lengths. And just like, they seem to be such a diverse breed, even though we call them all English setters. Is that unique to English setters? Or I know there's variation in all breeds, but is it more in the English setter? Or am I just like, is that just an idea in my mind?
No, I would say that you're right on two counts. One, every breed has a variation. And so any breed, so one of the universal truths about breeds is that the minute any breed is taken out of its homeland, whether just to the country next door or across the ocean, it will be modified. It will be modified to suit the local tastes. So a GSP in Germany is one thing, but you just have to go next door to France and the GSPs there are different. Same thing in Italy, but the differences are slight. Now you come to North America and the GSPs we have here can be radically different than what they are in their home country. So all breeds will change and all breeds will have variations. The English setter, for sure, is the one that has the most variations, I would say.
Okay.
Not only does it have the most variations, but it has the most named variations. In other words, you could look at a bunch of different GSPs, and I could probably pull up photos in about a 5-minute Google search that shows you the 10 different types of GSPs available in North America. They go from these little white rockets with the white body and the brown head, all the way up to these big, very traditional houndy looking ones from Germany, but they're all called GSPs. You're right. You can have these really big English setters with a long coat and these little tiny ones, but they have different names. You have cover dog setters. You've got Ryman setters. You've got old hemlock setters. You've Llewellyn setters, Laverick setters. So I think that the differences are there. They're greater than any other breed, but they're more obvious because there's names to them.
Sure.
And there's a story behind them. We know who George Ryman was. We know who Llewellyn was. We know who Laverick was. And their stories get embellished and they get changed and modified over time. And they become almost like a legend. And so, there's a huge variety of English setters. That being said, there is a common thread that runs through them all. They no matter how they get modified, they still tend to be they have certain things in common. And the example that I use, and I love this example because I love English setters, I have never met an English setter that wasn't an absolute sweetheart. I'm sure there are some asshole setters out there. I'm sure that there's some knuckleheads out there as English setters. But every single English setter I've ever met, I would have taken home because they were all sweethearts. They were all just easy to love dogs, even the way they look at you, just the way they interact with you.
Yeah.
Every pointer I've ever met, I would have taken home too, but for a different reason, because they were all business, man. I said in my book, even the name pointer is to the point. It's only got one name, pointer, period, done.
Exactly.
and of course we've got the Elhews and the Millers. We've got certain variations,
right.
But they are all, I say that the pointer is the 90 proof or 100 proof distilled whiskey of the bird dog breed. There's nothing, extra on a pointer. Everything has been pared down to the strict necessary on a pointer. Whereas the setter, there's some frills, the setter's got some extra little cool bling on it.
We've got feathering and
physically, even just looking at it, but personality wise, what's the old saying that if you've got a setter, it'll look right into your eyes. If you're looking at a setter, it'll look back and see your soul. If you look at a pointer, it's looking over your shoulder to see what's, behind you and how the hell it can get out there and find a bird. And it's true. But for English setters, the variety is there. And one of the things I say in my book is that it's like the English language. English language is the most malleable language in the world. It's the one that is the most flexible and plastic of all languages. And you and I are speaking with North American accents. It's English, but the English would know we're not from around there in 2 seconds listening to us. The guys in Australia and New Zealand speak differently. South Africa, they speak differently. And that's the English setter. It's the most universal type of a breed that has been able to adapt to the widest variety of terrains of all of the breeds, other than, the GSP and maybe the Brittany are sort of close seconds. But the English setter, man,
sure.
you can't find anywhere in the world really that hasn't, among bird dog people that hasn't discovered the English setter. It's everywhere from Japan to Argentina, South Africa to Iceland. You'll find English setters and they've adapted perfectly to what they're supposed to do.
That's cool. All right, man. Well, Pointing Dogs, Volume 1 and 2. What do you want listeners to know about these books? I mean, I can speak from my own personal experience. They are beautiful books, big coffee table style books. My 2.5-year-old son and I the artwork and the photos alone are, we could just page through them for days and days, but there is a wealth of information here, and you've obviously taken decades to put it all together, Craig, so I appreciate all your efforts, but what do you want listeners to know about these books and what will they find in it?
Well, a couple of things. I wanted to make sure that I made them visually captivating. In other words, it's a kind of a book. I sell them all over the world. So I'm selling to the countries that don't even speak English. And I'm selling quite a few to non-English speaking countries. Obviously, to some people who read and write English there, but to others who don't, because you can flip through it and not know a word of what's being said there. But it's a visual treat. I wanted to make sure that I got really accurate pictures of dogs doing what they're supposed to do. There is no single picture in any of my books of a dog in a show stack. There is no picture of a dog that's just been sort of posed and set up. All of the pictures of the dogs in my book are of dogs in the field, either in a field trial or in a training situation or hunting. These are hunting dogs doing what they're supposed to do. And so are they the best looking dogs in the world? Some of them are, but some of them some breed purists might see some of the dogs in my book and go, well, the angulation on this or the spot above its eye, I don't care. it's a hunting dog doing what it's supposed to do. My books are written, I'm a hunter, I write them for hunters. And I wanted to show people and showcase these dogs doing what they do. And that is hunting and interacting with their handler in game. On the information side, I wanted it to be as complete as possible. I wanted to have references that back it up. Not much of the information is from me. It's from experts. So you can take it to the bank. I quote sources. I give the background details into where that information is from. I try and lay it out in a neutral way. The Llewellyn Setter has people on one side saying they're good, another side saying it's just all fiction and whatnot. I try and lay out the facts of where this breed came from, what was the controversy back in the day, who said what about who, with the actual quotes of these people, not my spin on it. So it was really a book, or both of them were written for me because that's the kind of information I appreciate. I'm a very visual person. I love looking at beautiful pictures and paintings. There's tons and tons of wonderful paintings.
The old artwork is just is incredible. Yeah.
That was some of the most fun I ever had writing the book, was just going online and in libraries, looking up some of these beautiful old images and then including them in the book. Beautiful old photographs from, for instance, your Library of Congress in the States has some wonderful images that are free for the public to use and download and enjoy. Many museums around the world, they have their entire collection online, and you can look at some of these wonderful paintings and pictures free of charge nowadays. So I wanted to be visually pleasing, but I also wanted the information to be reliable information from experts, so that once you read that chapter on that particular dog breed, you have a good idea as to its history and also what it's like today. And is it a good fit for me? I knew that people were going to read these books and go, oh, I want a brack of this, or I want a this or that. Well, read the chapter and find out if it's the kind that you want for where you hunt and what you hunt. If you've only got 40 acres in the back 40 and you've only got a few birds once in a while, you might not want that, you know, high octane dog that's going to be 10 miles away from you, you know? Yeah. On the other hand, if you're way out in the wide open, you're probably not going to want that little bootlicker dog that specializes in hunting really close. The other thing I should mention is that Volume 2 is the current book. It's on sale now. You can get it through the Project Upland platform online. I only sell books to fellow Canadians. I'm sort of in charge of shipping to Canada. Anywhere else in the world, go through the Project Upland portal, and they will be happy to ship to you because it's much cheaper shipping in the States than it is from Canada. So you save a few bucks that way. Unfortunately, Volume 1 is completely sold out. I think I might have one or two copies. That's it. Just my own, you know, dog-eared copies myself. My parents might have one copy at home. It's sold out, but a reprint is in the works. We will reprint another, just a second printing of that book. Hopefully it'll come this year. If not, it'll be early next year.
Cool. All right. So for most listeners of the show, projectupland.com to get your hands on a copy of Pointing Dogs Volume 2, and stay tuned for a reprint of Volume 1.
And if right now, if you act quickly, I think there's still a few copies of the box set. Project Upland has a box set that has both volumes in it. It's a Volume 1, Volume 2, two-volume set that's been, I signed both of them, and there's a little card and a certificate of authenticity and this really nice boxed set that you can get. But there's only a few left. So if you really, really want a copy of Volume 1, the only way to get it now is to buy the two volumes together. And then, or wait till later this year or early next year for the reprint of Volume 1.
Yeah. Well, there you have it, listeners. Go get it. Get your hands on a copy. Craig, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to, first of all, put these books together. Like I said, they are a phenomenal resource. I'm certainly happy to have my copies, and I go back to them and reference them often, especially when I want to just look at all those cool old photos and artwork of English setters and every other breed that is in the books. What's on the horizon for you? I know you mentioned briefly that you're maybe working on some podcast stuff, and I know you're doing your writing. Anything else you would point listeners to that are interested in your work?
I've got a lot of work over the summer. We're relocating to a new home, but other than that, as soon as I'm there, I will be setting myself up so that, new podcast episodes, probably a lot of more video content, and more articles, more blog content, more stuff with Project Upland, with Hunting Dog Confidential. and I'm slowly starting to get to work on my next book, which will be on retrievers, spaniels, and water dogs.
Ah, there you go.
Hopefully it won't take a decade, because I don't have many decades left in me. So I'm going to try and get this one done a little bit quicker. But yeah, so all you lab people and Springer people and poodle people, water dog people, that's what's coming down the pike eventually.
That's awesome. That's awesome. All right, buddy. Well, thank you once again for the time today. I enjoyed the conversation. Hang on with me for just a second. And that does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Onyx Hunt is the number one hunting GPS app. Join millions of other hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. Onyx Hunt shows you nationwide public and private land boundaries. They've got topographic and 3D maps. You can track your route, location, and elevation profile. You can save maps for offline use and take Onyx Hunt with you wherever you go. The most comprehensive hunting tool you'll own. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your next Onyx Hunt subscription. Know where you stand with Onyx.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gun Dog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.